Welcome to Real Talk, real estate discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers to the industry. You can find this show at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Welcome to episode 9 of Real Talk. Well, we're now in the middle of January of 2023. The holidays are behind us. We're in the middle of conference season. So everything from CREFC in Miami to the IMN Private Equity Conference next week in Laguna to ALICE, the hospitality conference later in January, and then NMHC, and then a bunch of YPO conferences. This is the time where people within the real estate industry, and I assume all industries, gather and talk about the upcoming year. And hopefully the transactional spigot will open up. Haven't seen signs of it opening, but positive talk that there is momentum that later on in 2023, the transactional volume should pick up significantly. In this episode of Real Talk, we have Doug Arthur, the president and CEO of Century, which is a real estate company based in San Diego that focuses across all asset classes, from office to retail to industrial to multifamily. They are also an investor and shareholder of a company that owns and operates real estate in Mexico. It's a really interesting conversation that I had with Doug, and I know you'll enjoy it.
Hey there, Doug Arthur, my good friend, president, CEO of Century. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. It's good to see you, Andrew.
Well, thanks for being on Real Talk. I truly appreciate it. First and foremost, where does this podcast find you?
Headquartered in downtown San Diego,
home of the downtown San Diego. So you must be near the Padres facility, that big market team who overpays for free agents. While me being in LA, we're just like that little upstart minor league team that tries to scratch and claw our way through a division where, the big bullies down south are trying to just buy themselves World Series.
I could say that ending your season this year was one of the greatest moments of 2022.
Oh, that is just a stake through my heart. You cut me open. I bleed Dodger blue. I know you bleed Taco Bell colors, brown and yellow for the Padres. We could do a whole podcast on the Padre-Dodger rivalry, which usually is one way of, the Dodgers just beating up on the Padres. And we did during the regular season, and they got cocky and they were overconfident, and score when runners are at third base with less than two outs. And lo and behold, you lose 3 out of 4 games.
It happened. After a guaranteed World Series, it happened.
After a guaranteed World Series by Dave Roberts. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I saw you. When did I see you? I think I saw you after the Padres beat the Dodgers, and you were relishing in that and getting ready to beat up on the Phillies. And, the Phillies were that upstart team that I think we all want to be. So maybe next year.
Major moves this offseason, taking Trey Turner from the West Coast to the East Coast. Big contract. We just signed a big contract yesterday for a 30-year-old who will be 41 at the end of the contract. So, yes, we've got a lot of things baseball, but I know.
Sure the last thing on these contracts, I love like my kids now are 8 and 6. And so like when Mookie Betts was signed to a 12 or 13 year contract, I said to my daughter at the time, who may have been 6 or 7, Mookie Betts will be playing for the Dodgers unless he got traded until you become like like 19 years old or something like that, then he's no longer a Dodger. That's how long this contract's for. The thought of a player being on one team for like double or triple your kid's life is pretty crazy.
It's incredible. But this is the new market. Longer, yeah. More value per year, no trade clauses. And a lot of these teams are stepping up to make it happen. The Phillies, obviously the Dodgers, the Mets, the Padres now, small market to big market in a couple of years. So
I know.
Morris said it, we're a one sport town. So we are punching above our weight at this point, at least as it relates to baseball.
Oh, I love it. Well, let's talk about you and San Diego and Century, and just tell us about the company. I know we could talk about baseball all day, but we both decided to be in the real estate business. So, so tell our audience, you know, what is Century?
Well, Century was founded in 1989 by ex-Trammell Crow guys, which is a story that's pretty common across the universe that is the United States. Guys that were, you know, building, buying, operating office and industrial throughout San Diego County, including kind of the region of Otay Mesa along the Mexican-U.S. border. And along the way, we became kind of the kind of preeminent, you know, office high-rise owner in downtown San Diego, sold many of those office assets to the Irvine Company. I'm actually sitting in an Irvine Company building today, 225 Broadway. And then along that same journey, we met a partner in Mexico City and built a relationship that turned into a public company in Mexico City that's a pure play industrial development firm, now the fourth largest in the country of Mexico. The name of that firm is Vesta. It's now a publicly traded company as of the last 10 years, 32 million feet, about $2.5 billion in portfolio value. As I said, the fourth largest in the country, Mexico. So kind of our humble roots in San Diego led us to kind of pursue kind of value-added office now throughout the West Coast, as well as kind of industrial throughout the West Coast, as well as through our partnership with Vesta in Mexico. We continue to be a shareholder and a board member of that company, and it's a rich part of our story. Along the way, we also added, you know, multifamily and retail, but, you know, 75% of our portfolio by value is still office and industrial. And we added retail and multifamily, complementary piece of it all.
So, you know, similar to a prior guest of mine, Bill Shopoff, I don't know if you know Bill in Orange County, and hopefully you listen to that, that podcast, you know, he prides himself on just finding good deals and good value and irrespective of asset class. And so how is it that you guys, and maybe it's similar to Bill, but, you know, there's one camp where they, you know, a group goes all in on one or maybe two asset classes. And then there's a camp like yours where you're multi asset class proficient. So how are you able to be, I guess, experts around so many different asset classes?
So similar to Bill, we view ourselves as an agnostic value-added investor, kind of period at end of story. Now, I think part of us pursuing multiple product types is born out of the fact that we're headquartered in San Diego. And before we felt the need to expand our geographic footprint, we feel the need to play in, you know, multiple sandboxes. And when you're just doing high-rise office in downtown San Diego, it could be somewhat limiting, especially when a group like the Irvine Company came into your market. They buy, they operate, they very rarely sell. And they certainly haven't sold anything that we've sold to them. And so we felt the need to, coming out of the great financial crisis, to really diversify, not only by geography, but diversify by product type. And what we had to do as a vertically integrated platform is first focus on the people. We need people that had the expertise to be able to execute a variety of strategies in a variety of markets, which is a very different business model than saying, we do San Diego, we know it like the back of our hand, we live here. And so we had to reinvent ourselves. And so we spent the better part of, let's call it, the last 15 years reinventing ourselves from a people, platform, and portfolio perspective. And the people that we brought in had retail expertise. They had multifamily expertise. And so we didn't just start pursuing real estate new markets kind of haphazardly. We became an agnostic investor by actually building up that expertise first and then saying, now we have the ability to actually execute and execute in a way where we understand the risks and we understand the potential reward. So we invested in becoming that way. But the first, I'd say, 15 to 20 years of our company's history, we're very much geographically focused on doing business in San Diego. It's only been over the last, I'd say, 15 years that we've really kind of spread our wings in search of better opportunities and not just beholden to what happens to be next door to our office.
So how many people are employed by Sentry?
About 30.
Okay. And you know, where are you guys spending most of your time today? In what asset classes? And both geographically, whether it's U.S. real estate versus Mexico opportunities?
So in Mexico, the company is completely separate from our own. And so we have our own management team. That team is about 90 people sitting in Mexico City and some of the other larger markets. And so we continue to be an active shareholder and a board member, but the management team is terrific, incredibly well led. And they know their market and their product type and their client base better than we ever could. You know, we're there to support. In the U.S., it's evolved over time. You know, we, going back to my previous comment about being agnostic, are really focused on where we see the best long-term trajectory. And as you can imagine, given a variety of factors across the West Coast in the states of Washington, Oregon, and California, we're kind of rethinking that right now in terms of what markets that we want to be in long-term. We're not giving up on the West Coast. If you think about the state of California, you know, about to pass Germany as the fourth largest economy in the world as a standalone. So despite the fact that we're paying attention to, you know, the out-migration to Texas and Florida, et cetera, and we think that matters, and we think that leadership matters, we still believe in the economic engine that is California. We see what's happened in the Puget Sound region in Seattle. We've invested as far east as kind of Denver. So I say it's in that triangle, kind of San Diego up to Seattle over to Denver. And we're looking in markets for the first time like Salt Lake City, for the first time like Las Vegas and Phoenix, for the first time in markets like Austin, Texas. And right now we're probably in that exploratory mode of kind of trying to figure out where we can play best without paying a premium to get in the market because we don't know what we're doing. And so we'll spend a little bit more time getting educated. In terms of markets that we like, we continue to like California. We continue to like Seattle and the Bellevue market. In fact, I'll be in Seattle on Monday. Obviously, it's hard not to see the positive things that have happened in and around Salt Lake City. Phoenix is a very different market than it was in the great financial crisis. Denver's obviously grown up considerably. And then, you know, everyone talks about Texas and Austin has certainly been on our radar like anybody else. As it relates to product type, given that we can do everything, we like the fundamentals of industrial and multifamily the same as everyone, better. That being said, it's difficult to get multifamily done right now with the cost of debt. Industrial is the same. There's definitely a large bid-ask spread in terms of where we see the market given, you know, high 5, low 6% debt and where interest rate or what cap rates used to be. We've always seen grocery and drug anchored, especially privately owned kind of retail is interesting, especially where there's an accumulation of deferred maintenance, maybe someone that's owned it for 30 years that doesn't necessarily have an institutional mindset. And then office, we kind of break it down into two categories. It's either the best of the best or it's distressed. We kind of view office as the new mall. Whereas, you know, we used to talk about office or malls as, you know, the 10% that would thrive and the 90% that would die, be repositioned. We kind of think of office, maybe it's not 90-10, but it's maybe 80-20. And we there's office that has a purpose and a reason for being. And there's office that probably doesn't. And if you looked at where we office, 20th floor, good views, well thought out space. We want it to be a place that people want to come to work. But if our space instead was on the ground floor overlooking a parking lot in an otherwise uninspiring space, I don't know if that works anymore unless it's deeply discounted and or distressed.
So what, and thank you for that overview. In terms of how you are, you know, identifying opportunities as we sit here the end of 22, beginning of 23, the headwinds of interest rates, the headwinds of like what you said with office coming out of COVID. Are you, you know, how are you positioning your company in the types of deals that you're looking for and how the cost of capital has changed? I mean, our fourth quarter usually is the busiest quarter of the calendar year. This year probably will be the slowest. The third quarter was, you know, not far behind the fourth. And so as we, as a law firm, look at to 2023, and you mentioned price discovery, there just isn't any yet. And so what is it going to be for you to, and I don't know your last transaction of when you close, but what is it, what needs to happen in order for you to transact in 23?
So I'd answer that question two ways, because we're looking at it as both a buyer and a seller. And we've been a net buyer since 2010. So mm-hmm. it's kind of this moment of transition of, we'll be a net seller in 2022. We'll have three deals that will close in this fourth quarter. So pretty active transactionally on the sell side. And the only reason we're active on the sell side is we're trying to amass liquidity, kind of going into 23, where we think there's going to be significantly better buying opportunities. People ask, why sell now? Are you getting prices that are attractive to you? What we're finding is there's a segment of the market. It typically is all cash buyers. It's tax motivated buyers that are still paying close to yesterday's price, if not yesterday's price. Without getting into the specifics, you know, we sold an office building at a sub six cap at a record breaking price in a submarket that we think very highly of in San Diego. Mm-hmm. We sold an industrial asset at a sub four cap. A real sub four cap on a.
And are, you know, these are fourth quarter trades?
Fourth quarter trades.
Yeah.
These are deals that have closed inside of the last 60 days. Mm-hmm. We'll sell a multifamily deal at a buyer cap rate of a low 3%, where they're not assuming any debt, but they'll put new debt in place. Again, tax motivated buyer, although sophisticated institutional.
Yeah. So you're saying all cash, because don't you feel that in your conversations, the institutional private equity LP market, they're basically gone. They're not in the market right now.
They're not in the market. I mean, the reality is, if I look at any of those three trades, I think institutional capital, if they were in the market, if you found that one, would have been 30% off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not disputing that number, because we weren't buying at those numbers. But I think institutional capital would have been, if in the market, 30% off the mark.
Yeah. So groups who had a sale in the second quarter took advantage of those, the economy being different, starting to change in the second quarter, but definitely accelerated the downfall in the summer months, in late summer, had a 6-month window if they were doing a 1031 exchange to transact, and now we are at the end of that 180-day period,
and they want to place the money.
They have to.
They want to place the money.
So how does your shop capitalize deals from an equity standpoint?
So we're typically pairing our own balance sheet, right, alongside either an institutional partner and or high net worth partners, family office. So some of those structures are joint ventures. Some of them are programmatic in nature, whereby we identify a strategy and we pursue it on a joint venture basis, but over repeated deal flow. And some are, traditional syndications. You know, we've always been fortunate to have, developed a pretty diverse stack of capital. I kind of make the joke, but it's true that we have investment partners from five different continents that all have respect and appreciation for investing in United States-based real estate, with sponsors that have been around for a while, have a good experience and good track record. And so, we've never been in the fund management business. We've never considered being a public company, despite the fact that our partners in Mexico are a public company. We operate as a private real estate firm that is kind of always open to both deal flow and then capital flow. And we've developed some great partnerships as a result. But our more traditional kind of investment partner today is a high net worth individual or a family office.
And how are family offices and high net worth individuals that you talk to and have partnerships with, what is their outlook for 23 and the prospects of doing deals as a buyer? I mean, what do they need to see in order to transact, assuming there isn't a tax event that's causing an acquisition or contributing to the reasoning to acquire?
Real estate investment's a relative proposition. And what I mean by that is, we're not of the mind that the only thing that our investors could allocate to is our real estate deals. We understand that we're competing every single day with stocks and bonds, other alternative investments. And so when we look at kind of how the broader market is being impacted right now and the volatility, we still view, and our investors do too, real estate as a relative safe haven, a place where we can generate a reliable kind of income stream and with moderate leverage, especially at today's rates, at moderate leverage, we can generate an absolute return that's on a comparative basis, very appealing on a risk return basis. So we found that our investors, despite the volatility, are in some respects more interested in the real estate class because of the volatility in the equities markets, the volatility in fixed income. And so we're getting more interest. That being said, when we're talking about deal flow, we're talking about specifically what they want to be in, there's far greater scrutiny. So the bar has been, you know, raised 2x, right? And it's not just returns, but it's scrutiny over every single aspect. So it used to be that, you know, if you're talking about tenancy, you know, now credit really matters. Mm-hmm. It's not how long has the tenant been in the building, or is that business, you know, been viable for 30 years? Now it is an investment grade credit. And that's more from a foreign investor perspective, a lot more sensitive to product type. You know, industrial and multifamily are kind of top of the list. We are seeing some of our investors saying, hey, we too believe there's going to be distress in 23 and beyond in the office segment. And so let's look at this through an opportunistic lens. So I'd say our investors continue to be very aligned. Part of the reason I know that is given these three trades that we'll have, we're planning on rolling 1, 2, or 3. And when we ask our investors, what do they want to do? I've actually been pleasantly surprised that most of them, obviously for tax reasons, but other reasons, given the volatility, I was surprised most of them, 97% of them, had said, let's roll into the next deal. Let's find something interesting. And I thought, given the uncertainty in the marketplace, more would say, you know, liquidity is coming at a premium right now.
And your investors, are they, especially those that are doing the joint venture model and you're on in so many different asset classes, do you have particular investors for each silo? Like, so for each asset class, you have investor A, for multifamily, you have investor B for industrial, or do your investors like the fact that, you know, you have a diversified structure, and if you see a good deal, you know, they're really betting on you, Century, and they're asset class agnostic along with you?
Well, I think it's more the latter. I think what they view in our platform is someone that can play the game a variety of different ways and is nimble and entrepreneurial. And as the market's changed, we're capable of changing as well, versus the sponsor that may be in one market with one product type that you feel is constantly pitching you that same deal over and over again, because that's the deal flow that's available to them. So I think once they get comfortable with us as a sponsor and our track record, who we are as a team, I think it makes it easier for them to play kind of more broadly in the matrix that is our kind of investment strategy. And, you know, it might start that they have a preconceived notion. Our preference is to only do industrial. And then what we find out is we do an industrial deal successfully, and the next time we talk about doing a deal, they're like, well, we'd also consider being in your office deal or your multifamily deal. So it typically starts with an idea of what they want to do and how they want to play in the market, the real estate market. And then it evolves as we develop more of a tracker with them. Many of our investors have been with us 10, 15, 20 years, but some are coming in today and have a very clear idea on what the family has always done from a real estate perspective. And so we try to start them there so they can get to know us and have comfort in the investment strategy first. And then as we've developed more of a rapport with them, then we kind of evolve from there. And I think that's what's kept the retention as good as it has, because they can play with us a variety of different ways versus saying, all you can do for me is the following.
And so how do you select a particular investor or investors for a deal? I mean, you've got syndications. How do you decide, okay, for this deal, we're going to do a syndication model? Is it based on the capital outlay and the size of the deal versus going to XYZ investor, assuming you're not repatriating their money in a particular deal?
Well, I think it's a challenge because you have sometimes competing interests. Anytime sure. you have multiple, and we have hundreds, if not 1,000 independent investors of all different shapes and sizes, you want the people that are partners with you to feel like they're always going to have an opportunity to be partners with you. The reality is that's not always the case. And it's certainly not the case when you're pursuing a joint venture. There are times when deals get bigger. And he said, you know, if the average check for the syndication, even if we set a floor at $1 million versus $100,000, we're going to have 42 investors. And that's just too many investors. It's not good for the investment. It's not good for the other investors. It's inefficient in terms of the way we operate. It's inefficient if we want to exchange. And so we're trying to kind of align the interests of all the LPs in a way that we think creates maximum value. And so if we're pursuing a $100 million deal and it requires a $50 million equity check, and we're going to contribute, let's just make up a number, 25% of that, we're thinking, okay, with the net balance, who's the best composition of investors that are going to be most naturally aligned so that we can be developing a business plan that works kind of for all? And we're not solving for the masses necessarily from a governance perspective, but we're trying to. And so we're trying to balance those things out. But from time to time, we have conversations with folks that you can't meet minimums and wonder why we won't waive them. And I understand that and respect that. And we try to do the best to accommodate as many of our investors as possible with the goal of saying part of our value proposition is once you're a partner of ours, you're a partner for life.
Sounds like the firm. You'll never leave. So what will you used a $100 million deal as an example. I mean, what is your typical deal size range? Or does it depend on the asset class?
It's probably less asset class dependent. It's just we're opportunity driven. And so I'd say the smallest deal we do in gross dollars is $10 million. And that would have to be something that was adjacent to something we already owned, where there was
a strategic buy.
It was strategic. Still made sense on a standalone basis. We don't play the game of, oh, we've blended operations in there. It has to stand on its own if it's a new investor base. Just a good rule of thumb. And then we can go upwards of, you know, the largest transaction in our company history was a $300 million deal. And so, you know, 10 to 300 million, I mean, what we're looking for is bets that make sense to us. We've really had a lot of success in playing in this mid-market space that's, you know, be too big for the privates and too small for the institutions. We found the institutions have gone down and the privates have gone up just because, you know, folks are capable of doing a little bit more. And you know, you get private guys that show up all the time and it's like, I've never even heard of you. And you have a balance sheet that is unbelievably large. So, but that mid-market, maybe 25 to $75 million deal, $25 to $50 million deal has been good for us. Maybe 10 to $25, $30 million of equity is where we found more off-market opportunities where we're not competing against every institution.
Sure.
But that sweet spot is changed a lot over the last 15 years.
No, it has. I mean, I have a client and in fact, Keith Wasserman, who's also a YPOer, who's a syndicator, he syndicated $39 million of equity just a couple months ago on a multifamily deal in the San Fernando Valley. That's competing with institutions. If you're putting out $39 million of equity and you're able to raise that through a syndication network, that's an institutional size deal. And in my experience, well, assuming when institutions start transacting again, and dating back a few months ago when they certainly were, I was getting quoted minimums that were much higher than they were just a couple years prior because of how much money they have raised. And, you know, putting out $10 million, $15 million, $20 million wasn't moving the needle. And so they needed to put out $30, $40, $50 million on up. In order to get all that capital deployed.
Yeah, we've done the same thing. I think you have to move your minimums up, which doesn't make all of your original investors happy. You know, we used to, when we started in syndication, you know, 15 years ago, our minimum was $100,000. And from time to time, we'd waive it for friends if we thought that they would grow with us. And that's been amazing. But there's deals where, you know, similar to what you just described, you're raising $30 million in a relative syndication. And you say, but I really want 10 investors, not 100. And you're having to set a floor of $2 million or $3 million. And that completely changes the dynamic. You're talking syndication, but really among ultra high net worth individuals. And that changes one's business as well. So it's certainly an evolution from an IR standpoint. And I, you know, it's also an evolution from an asset management standpoint in terms of the level of service that you need to deliver and what your investors are expecting from you that is similar to what they'd see from any of their kind of institutional platforms.
So let's talk for sort of remaining few minutes about you personally. So you're president and CEO of Century. How long have you been at Century?
I joined the company in 2004, right out of college. Only job I've ever had. I guess I'm technically on the outskirts of being a millennium, a little bit too old. I was born in 1980. So I'm not a millennial. My wife is. So it's a little bit rare for me to be able to say for the last, you know, basically 18 years, I've been in one place.
Yeah. What are, I'm born in 75. So we're almost, I don't know if we're different generation, even though 5 years, you Gen Y? I don't even know what I am.
Yeah, I've forgotten. I think once we started talking about millennials, we forgot about every other generation.
Yeah.
Maybe boomers and millennials, and we're all just stuck in no man's land.
We're somewhere in the middle that, grew up prior to having a phone at 10 years old. That wasn't our childhood.
Right. Well, my journey to your question is unique, and I'm here because our company is entrepreneurial and we are vertically integrated. So it allowed me the opportunity to jump around and do a variety of things. So as kind of my understanding, appreciation, and passion for real estate grew, I could participate in it here. You know, I went from, you know, leasing to development, development to investment and capital markets and developing our, you know, multifamily vertical. And then from there, kind of, you know, we reshaped the company via kind of a succession plan. And that was about 10 years ago. And I've been leading the company ever since. And we've continued to bring in kind of new people that are, you know, certainly stronger than me in terms of being able to execute on a variety of tasks and add value. And so for me, it's been a really fun, you know, near 20 years. And I started with no gray hair and I've got a lot more gray hair today. I started with no kids and now I've got four. So that's me from a personal perspective, but it's been fun.
Yeah. But those that are watching or will be watching on YouTube, they'll see that your hair is, that's really good hair. You got thick hair. Mine is starting to thin. I may not have as much gray hair. I don't know. Would you rather have gray hair, but thick hair, like, you know, yours, or not gray, but it's spinning on top? That could be a poll for our audience.
I could tell you, I have a friend and I was complaining about having gray hair once. He's bald. I should probably have been a little bit more sensitive. And he said, you need to stop talking now. So I think at least one person has voted. I'm okay.
Yeah. So for to stay at one company for almost 20 years, I mean, that's rare. I mean, that is not something that you see a lot anymore, regardless of industry. And so what is your, you know, your, as president and CEO, what are your responsibilities? What do you do on a day-to-day level?
Well, thankfully, every day is different. And one of the things that always attracted me to real estate, dating back to when I first graduated from college, is how dynamic the industry is. I mean, there's just really no, it's an exceptionally large playing field. And so you can kind of run as many different plays as you want. And I've been able to play a lot of different positions. As it stands today, how do I spend most of my time if I'm doing it right? Spend a lot of time trying to think about how to build our brand. Spend a lot of time with our investment in the investment community, both in terms of building a pipeline on the deal front, as well as kind of capital formation and talking to investors, kind of getting comfortable with our partners. And then leadership. I love kind of mentorship. I've had some great mentors over my lifetime. The idea of, you know, coaching, mentorship, training, just trying to kind of outline a strategy that helps the team kind of perform to perfection or at least strive for greatness is something that is really exciting for me to do on a day-to-day basis. So if I'm doing one of those four things, 95% of the time, I'm a very happy guy.
All right. So in our remaining minute or two, I'd like to end on a sort of more of a lightning round. Are you ready for this, Doug?
Oh, yeah. We're going to talk about the waters again?
You will talk about the pot. Yeah. You know what? That will be one of my final questions for the lightning round. All right. If you weren't in the real estate business, what would you be doing?
I can't imagine being in any other, frankly, in any other business. I just can't.
A lot of real estate people think like that, by the way.
It's hard. Yeah. I'd be doing something that allowed me to be somewhat creative.
Best advice someone has given you?
Time is on your side.
I like that.
Be patient.
And we could say that now in our, you know, I'm 47, you're what, 42?
Almost 43? 42.
42.
Yeah.
We'll see if you answer that the same way, I don't know, in a few years. What 2023, by the end, let's say we do a sequel, Doug Arthur, the sequel at the end of 2023, what would make 2023 successful if you did what you wanted to accomplish in the next 12 months?
We had conviction for buying office. We find a way to get comfortable being that contrarian.
Yeah.
Not taking too long to kind of jump back into a product type that has become the new retail. And just confidently wading in, but feeling good about the bets we're making.
That's interesting. I mean, definitely a counterintuitive position. I know several of my office operator clients are, you know, focusing how to reposition their office into other uses. And the capital that I talk to when they speak about office, it's like using a four-letter word. So it's interesting that you analogize it of how retail was a few years ago. All right, I know your answer to this last question, but we started on this topic. First, who's going to win the National League West, and who's going to win the World Series in 2023?
I think the Dodgers will win the National League West, and the Padres will win the World Series.
It doesn't really matter what you do in the regular season. After, if this year is any proof, to win 111 games and to be out after the first four playoff, or I guess we got a bye after the first round, but it was disheartening. I'm not going to bring it up again, but we'll have a friendly wager next time I see you. Hopefully, well, let's do this. Dodger Padre game, whether it's at Petco or Chavez Ravine, we need to go. And then if one of us wins the World Series, the other will buy dinner.
I think that's fair. Just remember, it's 162 game preseason.
You just got to get in.
Game one. But I'd love to go to a game with you. We'll do a home and away, and I think dinner each time.
I love that. All right, Doug, you've always been so generous, and our friendship through YPO and beyond. Good luck in 23 and years to come, and thank you for coming on to the Real Talk.
Yeah, congratulations to all you're doing, Andrew. Thanks for having me on, and happy holidays, buddy.
Take care. All right.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and sharing this show with others.